Welcome into the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast from Hoosier Ag Today. I'm your host, Eric Pfeiffer. Glad to have you along. And today, we're going to talk about an issue that is maybe flying under the radar a little bit. Welcome into Hatch Studio 3A here in West Lafayette. We're kind of going around the state and around the country a little bit here. We're going to head now to Atlanta, Indiana. Kayla Jenkins is there with Beck's Hybrids. Kayla, welcome. Thank you for joining us on today's Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. Kayla is their government affairs advocate for Beck's. Hello, Kayla.
Good morning, Eric. It is so great to talk with you this morning.
Very glad to have you on. You know, you and I, we had this conversation about starting this Ag Policy Podcast many months ago now. Mm-hmm. I believe we were on a trip to Texas. We were headed to Commodity Classic. And I said, hey, what do you think of this idea? And you were like, yes, you should do this. And you were very excited about the idea. And you're like, hey, let me talk to my marketing people. Let's see what we can do. And here in a little while, we'll even like hear a commercial from your company. It was fantastic. It all like came together. So thank you for your support of this. And thought, yeah, let's have Kayla on. Let's talk about some issues.
Oh, yeah. This is a great opportunity, especially kind of like what you said, to bring up some things that are maybe flying under that radar or something that growers here in Indiana and the surrounding states just kind of need to be aware of coming up with regulation and policy, especially what we have talking about today.
Well, and let's get to that, because now we head out to Washington, D.C., where a lot of these things are taking place. Kyle Kunkler is there with the American Soybean Association, Director of Government Affairs. And Kyle, we thank you for joining us. You just got back from Europe. You're still trying to adjust to the time, and we appreciate you joining us at this early hour of 10 a.m., which I don't know what that is over there, but either way, it's got you all messed up. But we're still going to reach into that brain and try to get some information out at this ungodly hour for you.
That sounds good. I mean, it's got to be like, I don't know, mid-afternoon over there. Okay. Still or something. So I'm actually doing all right at the moment, so long as we don't go too late. But I appreciate the chance to be here, Eric, and thanks for hosting this conversation, to you and Bex for hosting today.
Yeah, really appreciate you coming on. And this is an issue, and we were talking, you know, before we actually hit the record button here. This is an issue, Kyle, that's really maybe falling under the radar right now, and farmers don't. You know, farmers right now, they're in the midst of planting still. We've still got a crop that we've got to get out there because it's been so darn wet here throughout the Corn Belt. Maybe some folks starting to wrap that up and good for them, but still a number of things that they've got their mind on. And that's why we really wanted to start this Ag Policy Podcast, so that maybe while they were out there in the planter, maybe doing some things, doing their stand counts, everything else, They could flip this on, put some earbuds in, and maybe catch up on some of these things. This is something, you know, we've got the EPA working on some things here in terms of the Endangered Species Act. And I know that I'm looking at an article right now on the American Soybean Association website that goes back to February. And this hasn't been... You know, and I've had some conversations with some folks with the Indiana Soybean Alliance who are dialed into this, but I haven't had a single conversation with a farmer who's really dialed into this, which tells me it is under the radar. Give me a high-level overview, Kyle, of what's going on with EPA and what they're doing right now with the Endangered Species Act. And you use this word revolutionized. It might revolutionize the farming industry, and not in a good way.
I think you just hit the nail on the head, Eric. I mean, and that, especially that not in a good way, is what we're really worried about with how implementation of this is looking. I'm going to take just a quick step back here for a second and talk about the Endangered Species Act. And actually, believe it or not, we need EPA to become compliant with the Endangered Species Act. They have historically not been, and that's been a huge source of problem for farmers too, because it jeopardizes the ability to maintain access to pesticides that are needed to protect crops. So we need to help EPA figure out a way to become compliant. But some of these proposals that they're putting out will, for some farmers, make it impossible to continue to using a lot of the tools that they rely on. And you know, you referenced our website in an article that you stumbled on. we did a survey of our farmers, our board members and some other farmers, and we got about 75 to respond. We asked them questions about how there's several proposals that EPA has out. One of the ones that's caught the most attention for those who are tuned into this discussion, it's called the herbicide strategy. And it's how EPA is going to bring their herbicide, you know, all of their herbicides into compliance with the Endangered Species Act. And we found that if this thing were implemented tomorrow, 80% of our farmers would be non-compliant, and about 50% of them would have a pretty significant implementation burden to bring their farm up to compliance, to continue to use the pesticides that they're currently using on their farm, to say nothing of new pesticides. I mean, we're looking at potentially billions upon billions of dollars in costs for implementing this thing. There's not enough funds out there to help farmers implement it. Just the practical challenges with implementing it are going to be incredibly difficult. So while we need EPA to be compliant, with what they're proposing is not workable, not even close. And we need to help suggest them, help them find a better way, so that you know, we can continue to access those tools, but you know, do so in a way that's going to be compatible with agriculture. And right now, that is not the case.
And Kyle, correct me if I'm wrong, what we're talking about, so we can kind of really put it a paint a picture for growers right now, is if you were to take that bottle of water or that bottle of Gatorade that's sitting in that cab right now with those growers while they're planting, and they want to be able to take a drink of it, they're going to have so many points in a sense on that label to be able to drink that bottle of water or that Gatorade. And so in order to get those points, they're going to have to do so many mitigation measures to be able to drink that. So it, you know, that's kind of a different take than what we're looking at in today's world.
You're exactly right, Kayla. So the two big things that EPA is looking to address, and we can get into a little bit more why they're looking into these things, is two big sort of buckets. So under the Endangered Species Act, and we'll talk more about this in just a minute, but they have to make sure that no listed, federally listed species, and they're in these two buckets, you know, endangered and threatened, and the differences there don't really matter all too much. But they have to make sure that none of those populations of those species will be harmed. And nationwide, there's about 1,700 of them, so it's a lot. And they're all over the place, from you know, from Maine to Hawaii to everywhere in between. And they have to look and make sure that a pesticide isn't going to impact those endangered species wherever they're suspected or found to be living. And the way that pesticides can primarily do that, Keila, to your point, is sort of two major ways. One is spray drift, and then the second way is any sort of runoff of fields. So these proposals that EPA is coming up with are largely focused on sort of those two main things. How can we make sure that pesticides are staying on the field, that they're not drifting, and that they're also not, you know, running off a field through irrigation or runoff, you know, rainfall or anything like that. And they to make sure that you're not causing those harms, certain things that you could implement on your farm, like putting in place spray drift buffers or using hooded sprayers or thinking on the runoff side. You know, you're given a list of practices that you could potentially implement that would be limit your runoff. Those could be things that would be as easy as, say, like reduced tillage or cover crops, but EPA wants a lot of them right now. They assign a certain number of points to each one. So cover crops might only get you 2 points. You know, reduced tillage might only get you one. And to use some of your herbicides that, you know, that farmers are currently using right now, some farmers are going to need up to 9 points. And a lot of those other practices that are being offered for compliance, not a lot of folks are using them, and some of them could be very, very costly to install. They could be things like riparian buffers, vegetative filter strips, grass waterways, things like that. And to put those in on one field, maybe not a big deal. But when you think, look at the cost, you know, extrapolate that, what's that going to cost to put those in across 1,000 acres, you know, 2,000, 5,000 acres? You're looking at, you know, significant, enormous cost for an individual farming operation. And then if everybody, you know, and all of their neighbors are trying to do this all at once, you're looking at, and this was a USDA estimate. USDA was expecting that, they did an analysis for herbicide strategy. They said one crop, corn, in three states, Iowa, Illinois, and Nebraska, could cost those farmers as much as over $5 billion to implement this thing. And so we're talking about the risk of potentially putting a lot of farmers out of business who may have a really hard time just figuring out a way to comply with this thing.
So,
It's also very interesting that we're talking about being in compliance with the Endangered Species Act that was enacted over 50 years ago, Kyle. Like it mind boggles me that we've had no updates, even though we've had all this biotechnology and updates in agriculture, but we've never had an update to ESA, the Endangered Species Act. We were with a couple of state departments of ags last week, and they were even making this comment, like, how do we look at trying to enact Congress to maybe get some updates? Is that even possible? But it mind boggled a few of us that we've never even had updates in 50 years to this.
I mean, it's a great point, and partially, like, let's go back here for a second. Part of one of the reasons why I think it's going to be a real uphill climb getting any sort of changes to the law is the groups that have sort of backed EPA and backed us into this corner, and a lot of them are environmental groups. They have a lot of what they want right now, and they have been suing EPA for years. Saying that EPA is not compliant. And actually, let's talk a little bit more about the Endangered Species Act and why there is definitely a square peg trying to fit into a round hole here. So if you go read ESA, which, to your point, Kayla, it was enacted in 1973. It just had its 50th anniversary. It's a projects-based statute. So you think of it, are things like, the way that Congress intended for what this intended this for is for things like building a road or a bridge or a wind farm or something like that, where a warehouse where you may need a federal permit to build those things. And anything that's authorized at the federal level has to be compliant with the Endangered Species Act. That's what the law requires. So let's take a bridge here for a second. If your Department of Transportation, say, is going to permit a bridge and you're building it over a creek, and they say that there is an endangered turtle in that creek, their obligation is to make sure that the turtle's not going to be impacted by that bridge. So they'll do an initial assessment, and they all come up with one of two conclusions: the turtle's going to be fine, or the turtle might be impacted. And if the turtle's going to be impacted, then what they have to go do is they have to go talk, Department of Transportation has to go talk to two other federal agencies, Fish and Wildlife Service, and then another one, National Marine Fisheries Service. We'll just call them the services right now. That's what everybody sort of colloquially calls them. They have to go talk with the services to check their work and say, we think that the turtle may be harmed. And then they will say, agree or disagree. And if they agree and say it may be harmed, then what they have to do is provide what are called reasonable and prudent measures and alternatives to that bridge to make sure the turtle's not going to be harmed. And that could be things like move the bridge downstream half a mile or put in special trusses or something like that to make sure the turtle's not going to be harmed. But the answer generally isn't no, you can't build the bridge. Now, like, let's take that for a second and now think about that in the context of pesticides. Pesticide registrations are certainly not a bridge over a creek. You're talking about something that's registered for dozens of crops used across hundreds of millions of acres, and they may intersect with all or most of the 1,700 listed species. And keep in mind, EPA is not just having to do this once, but there are over 900 active ingredients that are currently on the market that EPA is having to do this for over and over and over again. And that's to say nothing of all of the new active ingredients. And that's hard. That's really, really hard. And EPA doesn't have the staff or the resources or the ability to do this. So what they've historically done is ignored it. And that's not entirely true. They haven't ignored it. They've thrown in place some general restrictions on labels and said, if we put in place a spray drift buffer or, a few don't spray when pollinators are present, some label language like that, they say that that satisfies those needs. And courts have disagreed. They've gotten sued time and time and time again. And the courts have lost patience, and they're backing them into a corner. And they're saying, you need to figure out a better way to become compliant because we don't think you're even trying. And that's where you're getting these this has been a, you know, Kayla, to your original question, this has played out over decades. And so the environmental groups that have been seeking pesticides becoming compliant now have finally have us on the ropes and have EPA on the ropes.
So
Eric, go ahead, sorry.
I just wanted to go back. That was going to be my question, Kayla. I want to get into this thing with the environmental groups and you know the animal activists. I might be changing gears here a little bit because we're seeing the same thing right now in the farm bill as well. We're seeing this where we're seeing the conservation groups, and maybe that's a bad term to use because I think that there are conservation groups within the farming industry that you know we work well together. But we're seeing some things here with the farm bill as well that are going to hold this thing up. I'm not putting you two on the spot. These are my words. This farm bill, I don't think, is going to get done this year. I don't see it. I hope it does. Please, believe me, I hope that this thing gets done. I just don't think it will. But I look at this problem that we have, and I wonder, and again, I don't know that you guys know the answer to this, but I wonder who the EPA is listening to when making these decisions, because it seems to me we have these animal activist groups, these environmental groups that are way on that side. I don't know that we have anyone way on the other side of this herbicide issue. I even feel like the companies, and again, I'm not asking you guys to answer this per se because I know you work with them too. I'm talking about the companies that create them, like the Cortevas, I don't feel like they're way on that side because I think that they know that for soil health and for things, they know that they can't go all the way to the other side. And farmers, we know, are the ultimate conservationists. I think they know they need to be somewhere in the middle. And that's why organizations like yours, Kyle, and the American Soybean Association, along with all the other, you know, the National Corn Growers Association, you guys have to be somewhere close to the middle on this in knowing that farmers need to do what they need to do while still maintaining the soil health and maintaining what farmers need to be able to do. Like, shouldn't the EPA know this as well, and shouldn't they be, for lack of a better term, buddying up, cozying up to you guys and knowing that you have farmers' best interests, the soil's best interests, the environment's best interests at heart here?
It's a really, really good question. And it's got a little bit of a complicated answer. You know, I think EPA does understand. What's great is we all know, to your point about being original conservationists, we all know that farmers don't just use these tools to protect their crops. I mean, if you think, you know, if you think that you can do no-till or reduce tillage without herbicides to terminate weeds, good luck. You know, if farmers don't have access to these tools to terminate weeds, they just may have to go back to tillage. You know, how many farmers out there terminate their cover crops with herbicides, right? It's well over 80%. And if they don't have the herbicides to terminate, how many are just not going to use cover crops? So, I mean, there are some real environmental outcomes at stake here too, with these tools are making these conservation practices possible. And if we lose access to them, then that's going to impact the environment as well. And I don't think that's lost on EPA, and I don't think that that's lost on some of these groups who realize that these tools have some important conservation benefits. But that community is not monolithic either. There are a lot of them out there who believe that pesticides should be banned regardless. You know, we kind of refer them sort of to the abolitionist groups. And
the ones that don't want to eat.
That's right. Well, or the other thing too is like, look, I mean, you know, maybe we just don't have agriculture here in the United States anymore to some of these groups. I don't know if they've really thought about what happens about, okay, who's going to grow it elsewhere and how, you know, environmentally, you know, sustainable is that going to be? But, you know, to your point, we do it the best here. Like, we do it best in the United States and do it the most sustainable out of anywhere else in the world. And, you know, farmers want to do the right things. And to your point about that, you know, striking that middle ground, we really do want to find a way to do this that's going to minimize the impact on endangered species and make sure that they're not being threatened or jeopardized, and to do this in the most environmentally sustainable way possible. And we think that we can do that. But, you know, at the same time, this has to be workable for agriculture. And if it's just so extreme that it's going to prevent farmers from using these tools, we won't be able to stand for that. And we will oppose this, pretty strongly at the end of the day, if that's where the agency weighs up, lands. The one other thing to consider too, you have to think about who's been suing them over the past 30, 40 years. It hasn't been the farm groups. It hasn't been, the companies. It's largely been those environmental groups. And so EPA has that on the back of their mind. Okay, if we go this one direction, this may upset some farmers. But if we go, those groups that have been suing us for decades will be placated. But if we go the other direction and upset those groups, we're probably going to be right back in court.
I would imagine it has to be disappointing that they went so far this way with the original document here, the original thing that they put out, because it would seem to me that now anything that they give up at this point, that other side, they're going to fight it like crazy, maybe sue them again, because hey, they were willing to do it to begin with. And now anything that they give up, that other side's going to be going nuts over. And it just seems like that'd be disappointing.
You see the compromise right now. I mean, like, to your point, what they came out with was so far to the other side. And it was like, oh my gosh, there's no way. There is no way. To Kyle's point, all that analysis was done by ASA and USDA to really understand the impacts. But because of the voice and because of several of us advocating on behalf of growers and the industry, EPA listened and started adjusting this strategy and some of the other strategies that Kyle will talk about later. And so it's a good sign. It is a good sign that EPA is listening and taking in those comments that everybody submitted. They're really looking at the data. And Kyle, that really struck me on one of the last meetings that we had with EPA and USDA and everybody, is the data that they're looking for and having trouble getting right now. We're in a data-driven world. We've talked about big data and all of this that we're capturing, but like, how is it that EPA doesn't have this, or where are we going to get this data from?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, think about it though, but you have to consider every single pesticide out there, and there's hundreds of them, and the way that every one of them may be impacting certain species. That's a lot of data. And also think about this. It's not just that, but think about how various EPA through these proposals is wanting farmers to implement conservation practices. You then have to develop, data about how much, are those conservation practices protecting species. We also know that, look, there's differences between different types of cover crops or, different types of, different types of tillage and how they impact runoff. And so the data needs are just enormous. And so what I would say, Eric, I'm hoping that you've got some extension folks, some crop consultants that are out there that are listening to this. We really need those folks to work with their local farming communities as well, and start developing. The good news is that, Kaylee, you hit on this. The agency really listens to data. They have to. And putting all of that, giving that information to the agency, they have to do something with that, and they have to respond to that. And we've seen that move the needle to some degree so far, but there's a lot of gaps and a lot of holes. And so if there are folks out there from the academic, the research community that can start thinking through some of these questions. And we've already had some discussions with some of those academic associations and groups. The Weed Science Society, for example, is really tuned into this conversation. They're the ones that are out there on the front lines working with farmers that are helping to develop this data that I think are going to get us better outcomes and make this thing workable at the end of the day.
Well, since you gave me the opportunity, Kyle, I'll go ahead and I'll tout a couple of other podcast that we host here at Hoosier Ag Today, one being the Soil Health Podcast. We talk all things cover crops, conservation. That's available at HoosierAgToday.com. For those looking to get started in this conservation conversation, that's the place to go. We do also host the Purdue Crop Chat with our Purdue Corn and Soybean Extension agents. But the fact of the matter is, and Kyle, I think this is something that the American Soybean Association has put out there, and National Corn Growers Association, and a number of other. The fact of the matter is that on some farms, some of these conservation practices, they've been tried. They don't work. Yeah. For that farmer, for whatever reason, they've tried them. They don't work. Mm-hmm. I was at a farm just last week. While the farmer was trying to do some things, well, we struggled with it. It didn't work very well for our farm. Now we're just trying to do it around the fence rows here to see if we can get some benefit out of it. It doesn't work as well as what folks would like to think in some situations for whatever reason. And I think, you know, me, I'm not a farmer. I'm a guy who likes to talk to farmers and about what they do because they're really cool people. I have to trust that they know what they're talking about and that they know what's best for their farm. I would like to think that EPA and USDA and all of these other organizations out there would think the same, that these folks know what's best for their farm. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem to be that way.
Yeah, that is one area where I would say that thankfully EPA, USDA, and actually, believe it or not, some of these environmental groups too, there is consensus. The environmental groups, a lot of them want species to be protected. And if farmers can't do this, what's the point? Like, what good is that doing anyone? And so they've been very amenable and you know, sharing some of the same messages with the agencies as we have and saying farmers need options. Like there needs to be flexibility here because, you know, one size fits all isn't going to work. And there's just a lot of folks who aren't going to be able to do, you know, cover crops or whatever, take your pick. You know, I have a farmer in, you know, South Carolina, who's got a really heavily, he has to rotate 6 crops because his herbicide resistance pressures are so high. And he told me, look, some of these edge of field practices that EPA has said, we can't do any of them. He said, we've tried. And he said, all they do is create a refuge for herbicide resistant weeds. And so we went down that list and he needed 9 points for his operation to use the herbicides that he was using. We could only get him to 5 or 6. And so he's like, what are my options? Am I just going to have to stop using some of these? And we're like, that can't be the answer. And so thankfully, you know, I will say this, you know, the agencies have listened to that. And what they're looking to do is build out that list of practices and make it as broad as possible. And if there's data out there, coming back to this data question, to support that being protective for species and limiting spray drift and limiting runoff, you know, EPA has been very agreeable about being willing to add that to a list of practices that farmers can do to become compliant. And we're trying to figure out things that, you know, can be very, you know, the other sort of big thing on our minds too is the cost. You know, putting in place a 30-foot riparian buffer, you know, that's gonna cost a lot of money. And to do that over, you know, again, thousands upon thousands of acres, it's just not feasible. So what we're thinking through are there things that are like low cost, you know, flexible options that farmers can pursue? You know, can you dump in into your tank a drift reduction agent, like a, you know, an adjuvant? And can that count for helping with your compliance against, you know, spray drift? Can you take a course? You know, a lot for you know, restricted access pesticides, a lot of farmers are already, you know, and applicators are already taking courses for those. Can you take a course for protecting species and get a couple points for that? You know, these are the things that we're thinking through that could be a low barrier and can help farmers who may not, to your point, Eric, may not be able to do some of these practices that are currently on the list. But if we could build that out and add as many as possible, we hope to get that to a point where we could make this hopefully pretty low burden for folks to implement.
Let's take a time out here and let's come back. I want to touch on this more because I think there's more to dig into here. I'm with Kyle Kunkler with the American Soybean Association, Kayla Jenkins with Beck's Hybrids. We're going to talk more about this herbicide strategy from EPA and how it might affect millions of soy acres across the U.S.
At Beck's, we stand up for the things that matter most. Our faith, our independence, and helping farmers succeed. As the largest family-owned seed company in the U.S., we believe in the integrity of remaining an independent family-owned seed company. Since our founding in 1937, we have continued to produce quality products backed by a quality family of employees and dealers dedicated to serving American farmers. And that's something to be proud of. Beck's, founded in faith, forged in America. For more information, visit BexHybrids.com.
Welcome back to the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast from Hoosier Ag Today. I'm Eric Pfeiffer. Kayla Jenkins is in Atlanta, Indiana. Kyle Kunkler is in D.C. And we are still chatting about the Endangered Species Act and how EPA is looking to implement some herbicide strategies. And Kyle, we can talk about how, yes, herbicide is the focus now, but that might spiral into some other things. We'll get to that here in a moment. It's funny, we keep saying that. We'll get to that here in a moment. It seems like this thing just keeps moving into other things. It's a good thing that I didn't try to just, you know, fit this into a 90-second radio story or something. This is also why we decided to do this podcast. You know, sometimes we need like an hour to break all this stuff down that the government likes to do. So let's talk about, you know, we've touched on what the issue is and kind of how the issue came to be. Yes, we needed the EPA to get involved to help with this implementation of the Endangered Species Act. Yes, we needed them to get involved in how we go about this. Yes, they went a little too far in their original document in how we were going to implement this. But we haven't really gotten into the part where they actually implement it. Kayla, there are some concerns there about how to actually implement this thing. Who's going to police this thing? It's not going to be me. I'm not going farm to farm to be like, hey, you, I've got the badge. I think there's a joke out there about someone coming out there with a badge and, you know, running out into the field. You can't go out into the field unless you can cross it in 6 seconds because the bull can do it in five, something like that.
I've seen that meme. Yes, Eric.
Kind of funny.
It is. This has been like where I have been focusing on is just how we're going to implement this. You know, Kyle, when I started rolling this out, you know, that was one of my big questions is, okay, hold up a second. You are telling me that now our growers are going to have to not only do the seven different hats that they do today, and one of those being their agronomic hat, but now their responsibilities, they have to go to two different sites. Once we start rolling this out, they're going to have to go to Bulletins Live 2.0 to start pulling up these labels for those herbicides or insecticides that they want to use. And then once they figure out what that label requirement is, now they're going to have to go to another website to look at the mitigation measurements that they could qualify for to be able to use that label potentially on their field and farm. That just, to me, that is another step and another hurdle for our growers. And really, like, what is this? How are we going to pull this together? And so, like, that to me is an implementation problem. And then also, who's going to audit this? Who's going to be responsible for trying to understand where we go with this and what programs are we going to be requiring our growers to use? Because right now we know a lot of them are using more of those farm management platforms and some of that newer technology that we have today. So really, what's going to be required within those?
Yeah, those are all fantastic questions. And the short of it is we don't really know yet. Believe this probably won't shock you, but these are questions that we've been asking over and over and over again for the past year or so since these initial proposals first came out. And we don't have a lot of good answers. There are things that we can assume. Right now, look at who does enforcement. In a lot of cases, it's the State Department of Agriculture. And we, you know, there are some expectations that it'll probably fall on them. But we don't know what that looks like yet. We don't know what record keeping is going to look like, or if there's going to be record keeping. We imagine that there is. You know, there's tons of other implementation questions we just don't have answers for. Like, you know, what do you do in instances where you rent land? You know, if you have an absentee landlord, for example, and you need to implement, you know, some conservation practices there that may not be part of your contract or your lease, or you don't have the ability to change a field. You know, can you go ahead and do that anyways? We just don't know. And EPA, the one thing we haven't talked about is again, bringing this all back to lawsuits, because they've been sued a lot on this. they're currently under a court order to implement this. So this herbicide strategy, they have to have it done by the end of August. August 30th has to be finalized. They're actually going to be coming out with an insecticide strategy by July 30th of this year. So a couple months here. Next year, they have to have a fungicide strategy. All of this under this court order. So this is going to touch on every tool that a farmer uses at one point or another. And we're not going to know how it's implemented till we see the final thing. I will say this. The good news, there is an element of good news. These aren't going to go into effect overnight. EPA has been abundantly clear about that. What they're going to do is they're going to take these final strategies or these proposals, and then they're going to, once they, I told you that, you know, that they have individual registrations. They have to re-register right now over 900 active ingredients. And they've got every other new one to do. What they're going to do is start taking these strategies and start baking them into individual registrations. So maybe when they do a new one for glyphosate or 2,4-D or dicamba or whatever, they're going to take these restrictions and start baking them in to those individual registrations. And when they come out with that new registration, that's where the rubber is going to hit the road. And if past is prologue, so believe it or not, there are actually a couple that are out there on the market right now, several that actually have these on them right now. The new Enlist label, for example, if you go and look at it, there are some ESA restrictions. And Kayla, to your point about bulletins, you have to already go on that website right now and see if you live in an area where there is an endangered species and if you have to do additional restrictions. So there's already some products out there that have these restrictions that are part of it. But what we're going to see is more and more and more increasingly, probably starting, I would guess, starting next year, we're going to see a lot of these new registrations having these restrictions. And that's when we'll get our answer. You know, how is this going to be implemented? What is this going to look like?
From the standpoint of the state departments of agriculture being the ones to implement this, I would have to imagine, just looking at, you know, from a budget standpoint, Indiana has to be in a better position than most states across the country, I would think, just given our state government and where we are from a budget standpoint. But even then, I know that the State Department of Agriculture here in Indiana was asking for more money for their budget just a couple years ago when we did the state budget. But this wasn't anticipated. We don't have a budget session until next year. I just have to believe that this is going to be a hard thing for state departments of agriculture to just say, yep, go ahead, tack it onto the list. That why they were so upset when you were meeting with them not too long ago, Kayla?
Well, I mean, it's a couple of things, honestly. It's, when budgets have been set, like, this was not taken into an account. One of the gentlemen that came in and talked with us was an extension agent with Georgia. And he talked about this program and some of the things that they are doing right now in Georgia with their growers and some of the success that they've seen. But it's programs that are not carried through every different state the same way. And so this is going, they were talking about how it's going to be a collaboration of education and communicating this between not only state departments, because they don't have the resources and the manpower even to do all of this. So it's going to be a collaboration between state departments, your extension departments, those conservation groups and specialists, the agronomy specialists that you've talked about, and the state commodity groups and federal groups that we have and all work with. And so it's going to take all of us to figure out how to get this done and to be able to communicate, because, you know, Eric, to your point about this and Kyle about this bulletins live on like Enlist, I've talked with a couple of growers and I've just said, do you know what bulletins live is? And they don't. And they're like, we don't know what you're talking about. And I'm like, that's a concern. That is a concern of, we have all of these policies and procedures out there, but we have potentially hundreds of growers, millions, who don't know some of these processes and procedures, because it's coming out hot and fast and not everybody is able to keep up with it. So it's going to take all of us to be able to get this done to help our growers succeed through this major change that is coming.
It's going to take a lot of people, and I imagine it's going to take a lot of dollars coming from somewhere. Where, who knows, but Kayla, get your checkbook out. It's going to take some dollars to get this part moving. So ultimately, you know, we figured out, you know, this is coming, this is going to happen. You know, my biggest question with a lot of these things that happen, you know, we have a big presidential election coming up later this year. A lot of these things can happen and can turn on a dime with a change in administration. Should that happen, Kyle, does this even go through? You know, obviously, you know, we could see, you know, a Biden administration continue and things just continue right along. But should we see that change? Is this all a moot point? Or does it get thrown out? Does it continue? Does it continue in a completely different way? What do we know? What can we expect?
What can we expect is anything but clear. I mean, if there's a second administration, I think that you'll see this move forward and get implemented. Something close to has been proposed. I mean, if there's a change in administration, it's hard to say. But what I hope is, I hope that, you know, they don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, one thing I want to reaffirm here is that we need EPA to become compliant because the lawsuits just won't stop otherwise. But what we didn't really get the chance to talk about today, and it's a whole other rabbit hole I don't recommend going down, but what is a better alternative? And we think that there are better alternatives out there. And it's a lot of it is it comes back to the science. You know, again, EPA doesn't have the ability to look at every single pesticide and consider its impacts on every single species. And so they generalize a lot, and they as a result, they use very, very conservative assumptions that overstate how much they think a species is going to be impacted. And then as a result, they require more protections for it. And we think that there is a way that EPA can look at more data, look at more science, and develop a more evidence-driven process to figure out how much is a species truly going to be impacted, and then put in place any sort of protections accordingly. And we've actually seen a couple instances when they've done that, and it's been completely workable for farmers. And it's got the science behind it showing that it protects species. So this is a win-win-win. So what my hope is Eric, to your question, is if there is a door open to this, that whether with this administration or, you know, a new one, they'd be open to this idea of saying, well, what does a more science and evidence-based process look like? Because we know that that can be workable for agriculture, and we know that that can protect species as well. I think that's the best outcome here.
But no matter what, Eric, this is here to stay. This is not going away with a new administration. It's just how much or what potential changes. But that question of, hey, is it really going to happen? Yes. Unfortunately, guys and gals, it's here to stay.
I think you both mean an old administration. I don't think it's a new one. I think it's an old one. But whatever. It's all the same. And I did want to touch on, you know, some of my they might have been a little forward toward EPA. Again, you know, the EPA, it might not be the farmer's best friend. But I think, Kyle, that when we think about where the relationship is with EPA, I think we can go back to Commodity Classic this year. And I think from there we can think about how far maybe this relationship has come, and I think that maybe it's an important point to bring up here about where EPA is with farmers and some of these farm groups, maybe to where it has been in the past.
Yeah, there have been some serious bridges that have been built, which is good, and a lot of it has, you know, been based out of necessity. You know, take your pick, whether it's on pesticides or waters of the United States or biofuels, EPA has a hand in governing a lot of that policy. So we have to have a relationship with them. And, you know, they're historically not been a very agriculture-minded entity. And I mean, that's part of why we've seen so many frustrations and so many bad proposals come out of that agency over the years. And I think because we've been in there beating down their door so much, for better or worse, I think in better for better in this case, we've started to develop some relationships over there and help them to better understand how agriculture works and why we need good policy out of them that's going to be workable for us. And to your point, Eric, I mean, they announced, back in February that they're going to be launching this new ag office that's going to have up to 10 folks focused internally at EPA, focused entirely on sort of being liaisons for agriculture and developing good ag-minded policy. And I think that that's only a good thing. I think that we'll have more folks that we can work with over there that can sort of reach down into these, divisions within the agency and help us get better, more ag-minded policy, because historically that's not been the case. But again, I'm glad to see that the administration, this agency is posturing themselves more in a way that they can be more understanding of our needs.
Kayla, as we close out today's Indiana Ag Policy Podcast, any final thoughts from you? Again, you mentioned this issue isn't going away. You are working on behalf of farmers and your folks there at BEX to keep on this issue and others. What should farmers do? They need to speak up for themselves too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think one of the really neat things that would help is kind of we've touched around it a little bit, but just education. So if you have an opportunity to open up your farm and to be able to educate some of those folks from EPA or some of those other groups about conservation practices and what they can or cannot do, or just how your farming operation is, please do so, because they may not understand some of this. And so the more that they can touch that, see that, interact with that, involvement with that farm, the better off we're going to be, the more that they understand what we're talking about. It's one thing to sit here when Kyle and I are talking about it or putting it on paper in a letter to them about our thoughts on programs, but if they can actually see it, smell it, touch it, the better off we're going to be. If your local state associations like Indiana Corn or Indiana Soybean, if they are coming to you asking you, hey, what are your thoughts on this? Please give those thoughts, because we need that communication to go back to the EPA and some of these other groups that are working with them to finalize this strategy program. We need the input now more than ever. Advocacy, really, we really need to be to speak up, because it's not a good thing when we just put our head in the sand thinking that this is going to go away right now. So the more that we talk about this and the impacts that it has, and looking at how do we work together on this, how do we bridge that gap so that we can all work together on the same strategy? That would be my ideal thing.
And Kyle, just real quick before, I know you want to get your plug in here too, but I think it's really important to let folks know that, the Indiana Soybean Alliance, when folks think about this, they might think already that they're paying for, they're getting in on the policy side of this. And they're not. The Indiana Soybean Alliance, you're getting in on the checkoff. That's for promoting the Indiana soybeans. That's for, making sure that your product gets in on the soles of the Skechers and getting in on the Firestone tires. That has nothing to do with the policy side of things. You want to make sure you get in with the Indiana Soybean Alliance, the membership and policy committee, so that your dollars are going toward policy issues like this and you are represented in D.C. by folks like Kyle.
You took the words right out of my mouth, Eric. We're incredibly supportive of the checkoff and all of the work that's done there. But that's, you're not by default, through the sales of your commodity, joining these policy organizations. In fact, they have to be separated by law. And so what we need is more folks, and to follow up on Kayla's earlier point, I'd go a step further and say, please reach out to Indiana Soybean Alliance. Please reach out to your other state associations and tell them that you heard about this and ask them how you can get involved. So we're not expecting anyone to, to monitor what sort of public comment periods are coming out or what sort of proposals are, being floated by the agency today. But, if you're part of one of those policy organizations, Eric, to your point, then you're plugged in with folks that are monitoring all of that. And they can not only advise you of what sort of opportunities are coming up to weigh in, but how to best communicate what those concerns are. And we were talking about this earlier. Not every single practice is going to work for every single farm. The agencies need to hear that. Tell them what works on your farm and what doesn't, and how these proposals are going to impact you. And I think the best way that you can help communicate that is getting plugged in with those policy organizations, Indiana Soybean Alliance and others, that are tracking all of this stuff on a daily basis and can get you plugged in.
Kyle Kunkler, American Soybean Association, Kayla Jenkins, Bex Hybrids, thank you both so much for joining us on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. Let's get this issue figured out and make sure that we are revolutionizing the agriculture industry, but in a good way, not in a bad way. That's the way we want to do it.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to join today, Eric.
Thanks for having me on, Eric.
Today's Indiana Ag Policy Podcast brought to you by Bex, built on faith, family, and farming. Learn more at BexHybrids.com. Join us again next time on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast, and be sure to follow us, HoosierAgToday.com, Apple Podcasts, anywhere you listen to your favorite podcasts. We'll be back again soon. I'm Eric Pfeiffer, Hoosier Ag Today, Indiana's Farm Network.